Money Movers provides investors with real-time analysis of the stories and the people attracting the attention of markets each day. I'm Carl Quintanilla.
And I'm Sarah Eisen. We'll cover the breaking news and numbers driving stocks and sectors, helping you make critical decisions. Plus, we'll speak with the CEOs, newsmakers, and political leaders playing a role in how your money is moving.
Listen to CNBC's Money Movers free on the Odyssey app.
Hitting the news you might have missed. It's Denton's Daily News.
All right, Denton, what do we have today?
All right, how about another big night for the Capitals and a big night for Alex Ovechkin? No two goals, but he did have one in the Capitals 6-3 win. That's 855 in his quest to surpass Wayne Gretzky. But more importantly, the Caps 7-2 on the season with the win over Montreal.
Yeah, and this game got tight at the end of the second period, and then the Caps erupted in the third. And yeah, Ovechkin with another goal, Wilson with a goal. 7-2. I mean, Montreal, not the, you know, we had Joe B on the show this week. We had some hockey. We had some hockey talk on the show this week. Joe B was on. Tarek was on with us yesterday, and they both focused on the fact that the schedule that they've played has been brutal. They've played tough teams to start this season as they built a 6-2 mark. Montreal, however, not one of the better teams, and Caps are off to a great start. They've got the tied for the third most points in the Eastern Conference, second behind New Jersey, tied with Carolina and the Metropolitan. This is a surprising start. Good for them. I actually, you know, football was on last night. That was my focus. But I flipped it, you know, during commercials just to see how they were doing. And, man, it seems like Caps Nation is into this right now. You know, it's early in the season, but there's some good vibes about this team and the job that Spencer Carberry's doing. So good for them.
Yeah, I mean, I heard the game was great last night. Matty Ice, the producer for Chris Russell, was there. On Ovechkin, that's his fifth goal of the season. You know, Tom Wilson has six. It's really impressive with the Caps. They're kind of spreading the wealth offensively. So it's not like it's just one guy. Like, if you look at some of the numbers, like, there are a couple guys that have already scored 10 goals in 13 games, which is obviously not sustainable. But the way that they've been able to spread it around offensively has been really impressive.
Well, remember, too, Ovechkin started last season so slowly. Oh,
brutal.
When it came to goals. I mean, I forget what the number was, but it was just a couple of goals, and we were in December, you know, already. And then he went on that heater. I forget when that was, but they just started coming in bunches, and he ended up having, you know, a decent season. What was his goal total last year? I forget what it was.
So he had two in the month of October. He had three in November, two in December, and then he started to really heat up,
right?
In, you know, March and April.
31 goals he had last year. You know, not a typical Ovechkin year, but no, the pace is obviously much better. So what do they play? 82 games. They played nine so far. So he's on pace for 46 goals right now. I can do that math real quickly in my head.
That's pretty good.
All right, what else?
All right, how about Bob Costas announcing yesterday, or The Athletic learning, rather, that he is going to retire from calling Major League Baseball games after 44 years?
Oh, I didn't see that.
He kind of fell in. It was like broke right around.
Has he been calling baseball games?
You know, I wasn't sure about that. I would assume the answer is yes, based on the way this was worded. I don't watch enough national baseball games to know if Bob Costas is still calling it, but I would assume the answer is yes.
He certainly wasn't calling any of these playoff games.
I don't believe so. He's a lot older than I
thought
he was.
I mean, that you had the guy who's actually very good on Fox doing the World Series. You had the TBS guy, Brian Anderson's excellent. Right? It's Brian Anderson that does it on TBS. I'm pretty sure. Whoever does it on TBS is excellent. And the guy that's doing it, the World Series, I'm blanking on his name, with Smoltz, excellent. Maybe he did some MLB Network games early in the postseason. I don't know. Look, Costas is a legend, okay? There is no doubt about that. For me, I think in later years, they're just ended up being too much of a non-sports agenda at times with Costas that it wasn't my favorite thing. You know, I'll never forget the night that he was hosting a Sunday night game, because he was the host of, you know, Football Night in America there for a while, the NBC, before the NBC Sunday night game. And, you know, he did a long lecture on why the name needed to go. And, you know, the Skins are getting ready to play Cowboys on Sunday night football. Like, stop. Like, I don't want to hear that from you. You know, I don't, my diversion areas, you know, music and concerts, movies and, you know, sports. I personally, it's why we don't do this on this show. I mean, I have a lot of opinions, but you don't want to hear them. This is a diversion for you. This is fun. This is away from all the other stuff, even though we do get serious and it does get contentious at times. But I thought personally, no offense, and he certainly has the right to do it, that at times was a bit off-putting for me. But he was a brilliant, you know, broadcaster, brilliant interviewer, and very good play-by-play guy. The night that he called Strasburg's debut against the Pirates in, you know, 2010, that's one of the great calls when he had his 14th strikeout of the night. Costas, you know, he's done everything, man. He's done play-by-play. He's a studio host. He's done his own, you know, interview shows. He's an all-time talent. There is no doubt about that. All-time talent. But I did not know that he had something to retire from. Because to me, he's been somewhat distant from the limelight in very recent years. Am I right? I mean, I see him pop up on talk shows, you know, as an expert guest. And sometimes it's, you know, the hot button issue of the day, whether it's Caitlin Clark or, you know, whatever it might be. Yeah.
So it looks like his final broadcast was game four of the ALDS with the Yankees and Royals on TBS.
This postseason.
This postseason. So there was a couple of postseason games, or at least one, on the docket for Costas.
Yeah, all right. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, legend. Like, I'm Googling right now just to refresh my memory, because I didn't hear this news. I'm assuming that, what's his legend, like the legendary calls Costas had, a lot of them were Jordan and NBA of the 1990s. You know, certainly the flu game, certainly the shot in Salt Lake City. That's a Costas call. Over the years, like the legendary play-by-play guys, you know, for the sports that I watch, you know, football, baseball, basketball, you know, hockey, much lesser degree, golf, tennis, that kind of thing. I mean, Costas is up there, but he's not up there for me with like a guy like Pat Summerall. Summerall still to this day to me is gold standard. I think Al Michaels in his prime was unbelievably good. I think Tirico right now is great. The biggest thing with Tirico, he's so good at everything he does. And I'm not sure there's ever been a play-by-play guy that really has a knack for understanding some of the nuance to the game. You know, rules, game management, clock management, that kind of stuff. I don't think anybody's done that ever like Tirico's done it. Tirico doesn't have that voice that some have had over the years. All right. Hell of a career, man. Did everything, you know? Did everything. Didn't he have a late night show on NBC? Had a show on HBO?
On HBO, yeah. MLB Network, too, it looks like. I mean, he worked just about everywhere except for the mothership, it looks like.
Incredible all-time talent. Basically, you know, grew up in, he's a New Yorker, but his big start was in St. Louis. You know, he ended up, God, man, who told me this story? I think it was Billy Packer told me this story before he passed away, because I had Billy Packer on my podcast 5 years ago, whatever it was. He was such a good guest. I had him on a couple of times, and he had such a great memory and told so many great stories. And I think that he told this story about the ABA St. Louis Spirit franchise, and And, you know, that Costas was basically, I think, the first play-by-play guy for the St. Louis Spirit. I think that's right. You can look that up. But had a story about, you know, a game in which the owner was involved and they were about to shut down. And Packer was in there doing UCLA against NC State. It was a game that was mid-season on a neutral floor made for TV. There's a story there between Packer and Costas as well. All right, what else do you have?
All right, a little bit of bad news in the NBA. Magic star Paolo Banchero going to be sidelined indefinitely with a torn oblique. He had scored 50 earlier this week against Indiana. He's averaging 29 in the early start of the season.
Yeah, I mean, Paolo Banchero in his third season, right? Last year was not his rookie year. Yeah, last year was year two.
Correct.
The number one overall in 22. 22, I'm right, right?
Correct.
I think it was 22.
You are.
The other night, he had 50 on a night in which, you know, he was unstoppable. You started to see some of this happen last year. You know, you started to see there were games in which he was just truly unstoppable. He can really score. He can really go. That's a big blow to Orlando. They played, you know, they made it to the postseason last year, and he had in the postseason, and I'm looking it up right now because I'm forgetting who the opponent was, but there were some massive games. They played Cleveland in the first round last year, and they lost in seven games. They lost a seventh and deciding game at Cleveland by 12. He had 38-16 in that game. He averaged 27. This was his second season last year. He's in his third year. He averaged 27 in the series, but in a game seven, 38-16 as a second-year player. It's pretty good. You know, in game five, they lost. The series was tied two games apiece. Game five, they lost by a point. He had 39 on 14 of 24 from the floor in a 2-2, you know, swing game, game five on the road. I wasn't the biggest fan with him coming out in that draft. I didn't think he was going to be all that. He wasn't all that at Duke. But, you know, when you draft somebody who's 19, usually you got to give it more than just a year or two. He was doing it last year in his second year. Yeah, it was the 2022 draft. What else?
All right, your boy Mike Shanahan, Tom Coughlin, Mike Holmgren, and George Seifert. Are among nine semifinalist coaching candidates for this year's Hall of Fame.
Who are the others?
I don't have the list of the others. The headline was just Shanahan and Coughlin.
Okay, so I've said this before, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. To me, Mike Shanahan's a Hall of Fame coach. It's not just because he's a two-time Super Bowl winner and he's, you know, got it's so much more about his contribution to the game. Mike Shanahan's, you know, zone run scheme and zone run offense, because it wasn't just, you know, blocking zone wise and the identification of offensive linemen that weren't necessarily 320 pounds, but they were much more athletic, much more, you know, they had the ability to move and move laterally and to find backs who had that great vision and great feel for the cutback. And then everything that came off of it, the play action and the bootleg, which the Shanahans have always called quarterback keeper. They call the bootleg play the QB keeper play. I think personally he's a Hall of Fame coach. You know, there aren't many two-time Super Bowl winning coaches that aren't in the Hall of Fame. I think Coughlin can make the case too, no doubt. He can make the case. George Seifert, no. George Seifert's not a Hall of Fame coach. George Seifert was a Bill Walsh disciple, and that team was built and ready to go. Did Seifert win one Super Bowl with the 49ers or two? I think it may have been two.
I think it is two. I can look that up. This all happened before I was
looking
born.
It up right now. He is a two-time Super Bowl winning champion. You know, they went back-to-back. He won that last of the two. Then they were going for the three-peat when they lost to the Giants in 90, and then they won again over the Chargers in 94. two-time Super Bowl champion. I don't know. George Seifert does not strike me as a Hall of Fame coach. It's hard. I mean, I'm looking at his resume now. He was 98-30 as the head coach in San Francisco. That's amazing. He was 10-5 in the postseason. He only missed the postseason one time. He's a two-time Super Bowl championship coach, and he lost in the NFC title game three times, twice back-to-back to Dallas and the 15-13 Giant game that derailed the three-peat. The resume screams Lock Hall of Famer. He coached in Carolina, though, without Joe Montana and without Steve Young. And you know what his record was there? 16-32 without a postseason appearance. He certainly inherited one of the greatest collection of, you know, winners and star players in NFL history. You know, Barry Switzer, if he had stuck around one more year or two more years and gotten a second one, would he have been a Hall of Fame coach with Jimmy's players? I don't think so. But that record, my God, his 14-2, 14-2, 10-6, 14-2, 10-6, 13-3, 11-5, 12-4. Those were his records. His worst record, and he only did it once, was 10-6, and they didn't make the playoffs. That was the 91 year. That was the 91 Skins. Atlanta won the division, won the NFC West. And New Orleans was a wild card team. Actually, wait a minute. The 91, Washington played Atlanta after Atlanta played New Orleans, I'm pretty sure, in a wild card game. But New Orleans would have been the division winner. New Orleans won the division winner, but Atlanta pulled the upset. That's what it was. San Francisco finished third in the NFC. That was the NFC West back then, Denton. It was New Orleans. It was San Francisco. It was Atlanta, and it was the Rams. Those were the teams, and they finished third with a 10-6 record and did not make the postseason. Gibbs finished 10-6 twice and didn't make the playoffs. Man, Seifert's record, huh? That's pretty impressive. But there's a reason he's not in the Hall of Fame already with that kind of record. So, I don't know. I think Mike deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He was a true innovator in the game and a two-time Super Bowl winning coach. You know, his overall record prior to Washington, he had a 6-16 win percentage, and he won two Super Bowls, and they were 8-5. And you can say, well, you know, he had John Elway. Well, John Elway was not the star of those two Super Bowl teams. Terrell Davis and their zone run scheme was the star of those two teams. I think Mike deserves it. Does the time in D.C. and his record in D.C. knock him down a peg? Maybe, but I think most Hall of Fame voters understand that if you coached in Washington, nothing that happened should be held against you. I think any coach that coached in Washington during the Snyder era, honestly, nothing, you know, should be held against them. They had no chance to succeed. None. Mike was 24-40 here. Still won a division title, you know, in 2012, as we know. Do you have anything else?
Yeah, one final thing. Jeremy Reeves named earlier this morning as the Commander's nominee for the Salute to Service Award. So congratulations to Jeremy Reeves.
He gets nominated for all that stuff because apparently he is just one fine young man. And, by the way, a hell of a football player as well. All right, when we come back, my keys to a win over the Giants on Sunday. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're also free and live on the Odyssey app.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune
I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
All right, Washington and the Giants, Sunday, 1 o'clock at MetLife up in East Rutherford. Washington currently a 4-point favorite. Remember, they beat the Giants in week 2, 21-18. And that's where I'll start before I get to my keys, is that, you know, division games are always tough, and it's usually because teams are so familiar with each other, and here they are on the verge of playing the Giants for the second team. But, you know, this Washington team is very new to the division, new coaching staff, new players, etc. And while the two teams have already played once, they are very different teams than they were in week 2 of the season. So I kind of feel like the history, the division, the fact that they're so familiar with one another is a bit overrated in this situation, because they're not very familiar with Washington. This is a new team. Yeah, they played them once, but still different team than in week 2. The game in week 2 was decided really by a kicker, Graham Gano, who got injured on the opening kickoff. And the Giants couldn't kick field goals or PATs. They tried one with the punter, and it was ugly. They scored 18 points on 3 touchdowns. That's the fewest points you can have after touchdowns and PATs or two-point conversions that follow. And they couldn't kick field goals. They had to go for 4th downs. They went for a 4th-and-4 late in the game, in a tie game, 18-18. And Malik Nabers, their star rookie wide receiver, dropped a ball that would have moved the chains, eaten more clock, and, you know, potentially given them a chance to take the lead and maybe win the game. It was a close game. There were really a couple of key plays. That drop ball, the injury to the kicker, the fumble by Devin Singletary, which was forced at the beginning of the third quarter, and the 4th-and-4 drop. That game could have gone either way. All right, let's get to it. Washington beats the Giants if, number one, they don't let the Giants control the ball and the clock. Other teams now, I've been saying this for a few weeks, other teams are looking at Washington, and really we should almost look at it from the opposing view, because we've been doing this for years, and most of the time it's like Washington will win Sunday if, because they're an underdog and they got to pull out some things for things to go right. It's actually the other teams that now have to pull out some things and have to have things go well, because if Washington keeps playing the way they're playing on offense, they got a good chance to win every game they're playing. But we'll keep it, you know, with the traditional format of Washington wins if. You can't let the Giants control the football and the clock. They can run the football. They can. They have the ability to run the football with Tyrone Tracy and Devin Singletary. Tyrone Tracy's been a revelation, and he didn't really play. He played, but he had one carry in week two against Washington. He was concussed on Monday night in Pittsburgh after he had already rushed for 145 yards, but he was limited yesterday, which means he's probably trending towards playing. You know, the strategy to beat Washington, when you look at it from the opponent's viewpoint, it starts with, we got to stay on the field and keep Jaden Daniels and that offense off the field. We used to say that about a lot of the other opponents that we faced. Now they're saying it about our team. Maintain the ball on offense, run the football, stay balanced, because the Giants are not going to be a good one-dimensional team if that one dimension is throwing it. So the key is keep them from controlling the ball and clock, which means you've got to stop or at least slow down the Giants' rush attack. If they can run the football and they don't have to put the game on Daniel Jones's right arm, they've got a chance. If they can't run the football and the game then moves to, can Daniel Jones do it by throwing it, Washington wins. Number two, Washington beats New York if they get the lead early. And there are two reasons for that. One, the Giants are a team that is teetering, no doubt. Teetering at a point in the season where if they don't get a big win or if they don't get a couple of big things that are positive that happen to them early in a game at 2-6, there's no climbing out of 2-7. So they're probably looking at this game Sunday as their last chance. They played with great emotion and great intensity on Monday night against Pittsburgh. Like, I think they felt like they had a chance to win the game, and if they did, they could kind of turn their season around at 3-5. And they had chances. They did. But they lost the game 26-18, and now they're 2-6. And now you come in to this game Sunday, and if you're down 14-0 early, you're down 17-3, they start teetering over the wall to the side that says, yeah, this season is over. Watch what happens if Washington gets up, 17-0 or 17-3 or 20-6. So don't leave them with the thought throughout the game, like they had against Pittsburgh, that they could win the game. That game with Pittsburgh was tied 9-9 at halftime. They were down 26-18 and had the ball twice with chances to go down and score with a two-point conversion tie. The second reason you want to grab the lead early is really more about the game on Sunday, and that is if the Giants have to throw the ball to come from behind instead of playing in a game that's in a one-score environment either way so that they can stay balance, they can continue to run the football. That's their best chance. If you get a lead early and they're forced to throw it, it could be a blowout. Number three, they beat the Giants if they handle Dexter Lawrence. This guy is having a season. He is having a dominant season from the interior. He leads the league in sacks with 9 in 8 games. This is, a 6'4", 360-pound man that's athletic. And Washington needs to understand that he can wreck a game, and you have to probably devote two people to keeping him at bay to a certain degree. Because he's truly unblockable sometimes by two. Keep in mind, you focus solely on Dexter Lawrence. They do have other good defensive players. No Thibodeau, but Olajuwon can really play. The Giants have some defensive playmakers. I've been talking about them defensively. Now, the last two games, it hasn't shown. They got run on by Philly pretty much after it became clear the Giants couldn't score. And the game kind of got away. Barkley had a big run, and then the Eagles got a two-score lead. And then it got really ugly. But they have good players on defense. Burns is good. Okereke is good. Ojulari's good. They have an issue in their secondary. Deontay Banks, I think they're sitting down. He's had a real difficult time, the second-year player out of Maryland. He was picked in the first round last year by the Giants. I'm pretty sure he was picked in the first round by the Giants, Denton. Pretty sure.
He was. Banks. He was 22nd overall. He wanted to come here.
Overall. Yeah. He has struggled to cover and has really struggled to be a physical tackler and has gotten criticized a lot for that. But you've got to account for Dexter Lawrence. They've had a couple of those games so far, right? They've had, the Cleveland game with Myles Garrett. They had, that's pretty much it. They had Dexter Lawrence once. In that game in week two against Washington, Dexter Lawrence did not have a sack in that game. Had some pressures, but no sacks. You got to account for him. Number four on the list of keys to beat the Giants Sunday. This is just going to be a theme all season long. Just keep doing what you're doing offensively. I think they can run the football against the Giants. In the same way that I thought they could run the football against Chicago and Carolina. I think this has Brian Robinson, a $120 written all over it again. He didn't end up with a $120 against Chicago. What did he end up with against Chicago? I'm forgetting right now. He had 50 in the first half, and then it kind of got away from them a little bit in the second half. I think he ended up with 65 or 67 yards. But you can run the football against the Giants. They've been run on the last couple of weeks. Pittsburgh ran the ball against them. The Giants ran it to the tune of 269 yards with, by the way, a dual-threat quarterback in Jalen Hurts. I think you can run the football. I think you can possess the football. I think you can score on a majority, if not a significant majority, of your drives, even though I do think the Giant defense is good. But they haven't played well recently. Russell Wilson had a big night Monday night against them. Najee Harris had a big night against the Giants. So, you know, maybe they are just losing steam on this season. Get a lead, pound them, run the football. Just keep doing what you're doing offensively. It's worked. You've run it against teams that you could run it against. You've thrown it against teams that you can throw it against. You've done both against teams once you've done one or the other first. Washington's still a dominant, you know, team offensively, a dominant time of possession team, not time of possession, a dominant points per drive team offensively. This is a team that, you know, third down offensively, they are still top five in the league. I think they're fourth currently. Let me look that up. They were first for a while. I think they're either third or fourth right now. They are fourth right now, third down conversions. A tenth of a percentage point behind Baltimore. Tampa and Kansas City are the two best third down conversion teams. But, you know, flip it around. And defensively, you know, they haven't been able to get off the field. They've improved. They were dead last for a while. Now they're 25th in the league on third downs defensively. But if you keep doing what you've been doing offensively against any of these opponents, you're going to have a chance to win. And then defensively, if you get a few stops, you know, and stopping the run, I think, is the most important thing, you are going to win a lot of these games comfortably. All right. That's it. You know, all the other stuff applies. You know, don't give the ball away. Try to take it away. This isn't a game where you need, you know, multiple turnovers to win. They needed the one turnover in that opener, in week two, excuse me, to win. That was a massive play in the game. The Giants were on the move to not only take the lead, but extend the lead because they already had it. Predictions at the end of the show. Will the Giants or the Commanders be involved in the smell test this week? That's next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
Thursday Night Football last night, the Jets beat the Texans 21-13 to improve to 3-6. Aaron Rodgers was 22-32, 211 yards and three touchdowns. Devontae Adams caught seven passes for 91 yards and a score. Garrett Wilson caught nine passes for 90 and two scores, including a viral Odell Beckham Jr.-esque grab that had the world talking, doing the jump man in the back of the end zone. Elsewhere in the world of sports, Magic star Paolo Banchero going to be sidelined indefinitely with a torn oblique. He scored 50 earlier this week against Atlanta. He'd been averaging 29 in the early portion of the season for Orlando. In the NFL, Jordan Love says that there's a realistic chance that he plays this week despite not practicing. In Los Angeles, Puka Nacua exited the Rams practice Thursday with a knee injury, but the Rams are hopeful that the injury isn't serious. And then right here, Jeremy Reeves is the Commanders nominee for the Salute to Service Award. Congratulations to Jeremy Reeves. And that's what's trending.
All right, 9-7-1 last week. So winning week after a tough few weeks for sure. Still below 500, four games below 500, 54-58-4. On the season, but we got a long way to go, and I'm 1-0 already this weekend. Gave out the Jets last night, minus the two. No games tonight in college. Let's go to tomorrow, where Syracuse is hosting Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech's played really good football. You loved Virginia Tech, Denton, before the season started. And the truth is they've really started to play excellent football. They're 5-3. They've got a three-game win streak. It should be four in a row. That game that they lost to Miami was an absolute travesty in terms of that, you know, Hail Mary last play call that should have absolutely been a score, should not have been overturned anyway, and they'd be on a four-game win streak. The game they're going to really be upset about is that loss to Rutgers at home, you know, towards the end of September. The loss to Vanderbilt certainly doesn't look bad in week one. Virginia Tech's playing well. They've beaten, you know, handily Stanford, BC, and Georgia Tech the last 3 weeks. Syracuse got demolished last week at Pitt. But after a three-game road trip, they are back home. They're catching four against Virginia Tech. The public really likes the Hokies right now and what they're doing. I'll take Syracuse plus the four at home against Tech. Here's a line that just doesn't make sense. Minnesota looked impressive last week beating Maryland. Okay, I mean, the game was never a game. The Terps lost 48-23. That was their follow-up to the USC win. Minnesota must be decent, Denton. They're favored at 24th-ranked Illinois. They're a three-point favorite. I actually like Brett Bielema. I like Illinois. But I had Oregon last week giving the big number, and they covered against Illinois. The odds makers clearly do not like Illinois. They do not think that they are as good as their record indicates. They are 6-2. Minnesota is 5-3. They've won three in a row. One of those wins was against USC at home. But USC is not good. And the other two were at UCLA. They stink. And Maryland, who's not that good. So this is a weird, weird line. Minnesota favored. No injuries are driving this. Minnesota's a three-point favorite in Champaign-Urbana. That would be the home of the Fighting Illini. I'll take Minnesota and lay the three because everybody's on Illinois. Here's another strange line, Denton. What do you do you know what the Auburn-Vanderbilt line is?
I do not. I haven't looked at it yet.
What do you think the Auburn-Vanderbilt line should be?
What it should be is it's at Vanderbilt.
It's at Auburn.
Right? It's at Auburn. I would say then it would be Auburn minus 2.5.
They're a 7.5-point favorite over Vanderbilt.
Whoa.
The team that beat Alabama, that lost by 3 to Texas last week, that's having a great season. We both love Diego Pavia, the quarterback of Vanderbilt. Auburn is not having a good season. They are 3-5. They beat Kentucky last week on the road. They should have beaten Missouri the week before. I've had them the last 2 weeks. I got the push against Missouri, but that was should have been a win. And I got the win last week against Kentucky. But, I mean, this is a massive public dog, Vanderbilt, this week. They look at the line, they're like, wait a minute. This doesn't make any sense. And look, I told you last week UCF being favored over BYU did not make sense. As it turns out, it didn't make sense because BYU throttled UCF, and I didn't win that one. But this is a pure system play. I'll buy the half point and take Auburn laying the 7. Indiana right now ranked, you know, what are they ranked, 12th, whatever they are, undefeated, 8-0. They're going back to Rourke, by the way, to start in East Lansing tomorrow against Michigan State. They can't make a number big enough to get people off Indiana. Last week, I had Washington getting points against them. It looked short. Washington actually hung in there. It was closer than the final score indicated. But Indiana is right now 7-1 against the number this year. Their only non-cover was their opening game of the year. They were 26-point favorites over Florida International, and they won by 24. They've been a covering machine. I'm going to go against them this week. I'm going to just take a flyer on Michigan State plus the 8 at home. You know, Sparty's played well. They beat Iowa at home a few weeks ago. They're a better team than I think most thought. They're 4-4. They are fighting for bowl eligibility in Smith's first year. I'm going to take Michigan State plus the 8 in that one. UCLA, the Fighting Eric Bieniemies, got some points last week. They scored 35 in their last outing, not last week, 2 weeks ago, at Rutgers, a team that's really failing. They were the last team, I think you pointed this out to me, Denton, to score 20 or more in college football. They're getting a shorter number at Nebraska after Nebraska looked really impressive at Ohio State. It's 6.5. I'll buy the half point and take the Bruins +7 in Lincoln. Florida State, I've been on the wrong side of them multiple times this year, and it may be another one that I'm on the wrong side of. I'm going to take them at home +3 against North Carolina, who blew out Virginia last week. I mean, Florida State's 1-7. They're still fighting. I mean, they played Duke tough. They played Clemson tough. Carolina, you know, coming off a 27-point win in Charlottesville. Public likes the Heels. I'll take the Noles. You know, and you knew this earlier in the week, that I was going to have South Carolina for the maximum allowed. Texas A&M, big emotional comeback win in College Station last week against LSU, and they're laying 3 in Columbia against South Carolina. Give me the Gamecocks +3. By the way, they can really play some defense. That team can. Here's another line that just is weird. Pitt's an undefeated football team. The University of Pittsburgh, that is. They're 7-0. They are ranked high. They are playing on the road in Dallas against SMU. You talk about a neighborhood that's beautiful. Highland Park, University Park, Dallas. If you're ever in Dallas, just drive through that neighborhood and then drive to SMU, which is in that neighborhood. What a beautiful school that is. SMU's really good. Do you know they turn the ball over? You know this, Denton, as a college football host on the College Football Recap show on Sirius XM. They turned the ball over 6 times last week against Duke and won the game by a point. Has that ever happened? A team -6 in the turnover margin and won?
I'm sure it's happened before. It doesn't happen often. You don't want to live in that territory for too long.
SMU's laying 7 at home against Pitt. I'll take the favorite, the Mustangs at home. And then Nevada +2 on Saturday against Colorado State. They're a 3-6 team. They've played 9 games already. Crazy. And there's sharp action, super sharp action on Nevada. Let's go to Sunday. I'm already 1-0 on the NFL this week. And we'll start in Jersey. So the Giants +4, you got to know this, right? You got to know that the Washington Commanders have become a favorite of the public bettor. And look, they have treated the bettors well. They are 6-1-1 this year against the number. The Giants are 2-5-1 against the number. Washington's one push was the Baltimore game. They were +7 in that game, and they lost by 7. And their only loss was Tampa in the opener, where they were getting 3.5-4, and they lost by 17. The world is on Washington Sunday. I don't love having the Giants. You know what my record is in games involving Washington over long, long stretches of time with this stupid smell test segment that I do. 64.5%. I'm 1-2, though, this year. 1-2. I had the Giants against them in week 2 and lost that. I had them as a winner against Cincinnati. And then I had Cleveland against them and lost that one. So I'm 1-2. I pulled the Panthers pick before. But I got to go Giants here +4. It's a system pick. You know, on general principle, everybody, every bookmaker on the planet is going to need New York to cover the 4. So Washington wins, you know, little 24-21 kind of a game, maybe. The Ravens are laying a hefty number to a team in Denver that's been playing well. And with Baltimore coming off a loss, believe it or not, the public likes the Broncos on the road Sunday at M&T Bank. I'll take Baltimore and lay the big number. The Dolphins are getting 6 at Buffalo. The Bills on a roll. Miami losing last week and Tua's return to Arizona. I'll take the Dolphins less than a touchdown, getting 6. The public thinks that number is short. And then Sunday night, Indy on the road. I think Minnesota's about to take a turn You know, they've lost two in a row. The defense has given up some stuff in the last two games. Darnold is absolutely terrible under pressure. I think he's number two in the league in sack percentage. Just does not handle pressure well. They've got Flacco back on the field for this one. I'll take Indy plus 5.5 on Sunday night. So, tomorrow, Syracuse, Minnesota, Auburn, UCLA, Michigan State, Florida State, South Carolina, SMU, and Nevada. And then Sunday, the Giants, Ravens, Dolphins, and Colts. There's your smell test for week 10 the overall football season, week 9 of the NFL season. Up next, we'll go around the league, talk about the big games for Sunday in the NFL. There's a big one Monday night as well at Arrowhead as the Chiefs try to stay undefeated. We'll get to that next. Denton's got a college football preview. We'll talk Ohio State, Penn State, and we'll have somebody on to talk Giants at 12:40. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC's senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.